This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you, Amar. My name's Peter Stanley. I run the Centre for Historical Research here. Amar, to paraphrase Jane Austen, you have delighted us for too long. And I'm sure your students get a great deal of practice in listening. This means we're going to have to change our programme slightly, and I've asked Judy and I'll have to ask the two Pickerings to speak for slightly less time, so that we keep to program. But that was a terrific kickoff. Thank you very much. We're talking about memory, and there are many dimensions of what memory means. And in a place like this, we can see what those dimensions are, from the human, the grander scale, the national, communal, family, and individual memories. And all of those dimensions impinge upon what happens outside of those doors in the National Museum. So this first session is devoted to trying to understand what this thing memory is. Our first session, What is a Memory?, will be introduced by Dr. Judy Slee. And Judy gives us a very valuable perspective, because hers is that of a cognitive scientist, a person with a great deal of experience working at the Department of Psychology at ANU. And she'll draw on the insights of experimental and cognitive psychology to give us an understanding of the phenomenon of memory. Judy, thanks.
Thank you, Peter, and good morning, everyone. I'm stronger on memory than I am on sight, so mine will be rather academic and not terribly related to sights, except that I think that you will get from it some idea of what it is that people are trying to reinstate in sights. Now, I've titled my talk Memory Illusions. I don't need it yet. That's it. Okay. I've titled my talk Memory Illusions... Because I'll just turn that off for a minute. That's okay. Because when we talk about reinstating memories in landscapes, the temptation is to think that what is being reinstated is something that's really veridical, something that really happened. Now, memory can be accurate. The idea that it's always accurate stems from at least an implicit notion that what you do when you make a memory is you take a sort of mental snapshot, you file it away in the old filing cabinet back there, and then at the appropriate time you open up the old filing cabinet and take it out again. Not so. Memory is a construction, and as a construction, it's a reconstruction of what's happened before. And as a reconstruction, it can be a correct one or it can be incorrect in terms of actual fact. But it doesn't really matter, does it? Even if your memory isn't veridical, it being your memory, it's your reality. But I'm going to talk today about illusions of memory, just to show that realities may not correspond with the actual objective reality, that internal reality, may not correspond with objective external realities. And then I want you to ask yourselves, perhaps, what is it that when we're trying to reinstate memory in landscape, what is it we're reinstating? Is it an actual veridical thing, or is it, as Louise Douglas said, memory refracted through various things? Now, I'm going to talk about three very common sources of memory illusion or memory distortion. But before I do, I'd like to engage you, if I may, in a little tiny sort of mini experiment. I'm going to read you a list of words. I'm going to read them at a rate of about 1 per second, and I want you to try and remember them. Don't write them down, that's cheating. Just keep them in your head, and later on I'll see how well you remember them. Okay? Here are the words. Family. Female. Mary. Pregnant. Birth. Loving. Lady. Daughter. Son. Caring. Gentle. Woman, baby. Okay, give you a minute to go over those. Okay, now my three sources of memory illusion. Now, there are many, many sources of memory illusion. There are many, many sources of mistakes in memory. I won't call them memory illusions anymore. The three I'm going to talk about today are three of many. And why I've chosen these three is because they're the things that have been particularly selected out by cognitive psychologists to study. And so I have more to say about them than I have to say about anything else. Now, the The sources of memory distortion that I want to talk about, I'm going to divide into two classes. In one class of memory distortion, you experience the event, the to-be-remembered event, and after you experience it, somebody comes along and describes it to you and describes in slightly different terms from what actually occurred. Now, that sort of distortion that comes after you've experienced the event is called by cognitive psychologists, excuse the jargon, retroactive interference. It comes after you've seen it. Now, that's a fairly obvious source of memory distortion. A not so obvious source of memory distortion is the circumstances that existed before you came across the event you want to remember, and that is called proactive interference. And in this symposium, that is probably more relevant than retroactive interference. But let's talk about retroactive interference first. The first type of... I'm going to talk about two types of retroactive interference and one type of proactive interference. Okay. Now, the first type of retroactive interference I want to talk about is called the misinformation effect. You'll just have to put up with jargon. Psychologists are full of it. And it's called the misinformation effect. It was an effect discovered by a woman that you often see on television, actually, called Elizabeth Loftus. Now, what Elizabeth Loftus did was subject people to a visual experience. It might have been a real experience, it might have been videotape, it might have been slides. And then she would give them some sort of a distractor task, like writing an essay or something like that. And after 10 minutes or so of that, she'd come back and she'd give them some false information. Some people would have false information. Other people would not have the false information. And what she would do then was say, OK, let's take an example. You might say that the original might have been a blue car going through a stop sign. And the false information might have said the car was green. And later on, people had asked to choose between whether it was a blue car or a green car. Now, those who'd been fed the false information, which is green, at a much higher level said it was a green car than people who hadn't had the false information. Now, you might have thought that maybe there's a difference in time. The people who weren't given the false information were given a filler task, so that the same time elapsed between seeing the original slide and the actual test phase. Now, it's not that everyone is fooled by that, but many people can get fooled by that. Even more worrying from a forensic point of view is loaded questions. Now, in one of her experiments, Elizabeth Loftus had two cars coming together, and then she asked five groups of people various things, and there they are up on there. She said, how far... Oh, not up there now. Sorry, Leanne. There. You have to wait for a minute. She said, she had five groups of people. She would say to people... How fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, down to how fast were the cars going when they collided with each other, bumped into each other, hit each other, or contacted each other? And she asked people, these are Americans, of course, and this is miles per hour, so it's a lot worse than it seems to us who use 40 kilometres as nothing, is it? 40 miles per hour exceeds the speed limit in America by 10 miles per hour. And depending on the verb they used in that questioning, you got different estimates of how many miles per hour the cars were going. So if you said smashed, you're exceeding the speed limit. If you say contacted, you're just going a tiny bit over the speed limit. Now, that's a little worrying. I mean, not in this context, but in a legal context, that's quite worrying. You'd imagine a clever barrister doing things like that with loaded questions and getting different answers. Okay, so that's the misinformation effect. It is a retroactive interference of memory to memory, and it occurs after the to-be-remembered event. Now, another kind of retroactive interference is not interference by someone else, it's interference by yourself. And there are mostly... Let me do this backwards. mostly when you see something you want to remember, a verbal description is very, very helpful. So you see a robbery, you see the getaway car, you say red car, and that's helpful later. But there are a class of things where a verbal description afterwards not only doesn't help memory, it actually hinders it. And that is called verbal overshadowing, and that was discovered only in the 1990s by a man called Schooler, Jonathan Schooler, spelt school with a R on the end. Okay. And what he did was, he said, there are some classes of things where a verbal description will actually impair the memory rather than enhance the memory. And those things are things like faces is the one that's been done most, but there are other things and I'll mention them at the end. Now, faces are things that we're very perceptually very good. Recognition memory for faces is brilliant until you get to my age. It's not so brilliant then. But it is quite brilliant. But our verbal ability to describe a face in a way that allows you to distinguish it from some other face is very poor. So where verbalisation impairs memory is where there's a big discrepancy between perceptual ability, great, and verbal ability, lousy. Okay. So what Schooler did in his original experiment, and I've got it here. Oh, I did have it here. I don't have it here. Never mind. What Schooler did in his original experiment... I don't think it's that one. No, it's not. It's Peter anyway. Oh, it's on the side. Yes, thanks, Leanne. memory and I don't remember anything. What Schooler did to test out this idea that maybe if there was a big discrepancy between perceptual ability and verbal ability, maybe a verbal description, instead of helping like it does in most cases, hinders, what he did was he gave people a face to look at. Then he divided the groups into two groups, an experimental group and a control group. And after a distractor task, he then asked the experimental group to write a verbal description of the face they'd seen before. And the control group spent the same time, you've got to have the same time elapsing between the original presentation and the test. They gave them totally unrelated tasks to do add-ups or something like that. And what he found, then he asked them, after a suitable interval, to choose the face they had seen before. It's a recognition test, to choose the face they had seen before from 8 alternative faces. And this is what he found. Which way is it? Is that right? That's right? Okay. Now, this is just the accuracy. The verbalisation group only had 38% choosing the right face. And it's quite a hard task because the face had to be similar. The control group had a 64% correct rate. Now, that is statistically significant. But what interests me more than anything else, and this, again, from a forensic point of view, is how confident people were. Now, the verbalisation group got some right. When they got them right, they were less confident than the control group that they were right. The control group obviously got some wrong, and the interesting thing is that when they were incorrect, the verbalisation group were more confident in their incorrect decisions than the control group. Now, I think that's very interesting, because when a barrister has you on a stand, he's often pumping away at your... he's attacking your confidence more than anything else. Okay, so they're the two retroactive interference things. I'm being highly selective today, but they're the two retroactive interference examples I want to use today. One is misinformation effect, that is, someone else gives you the wrong information. The second one is verbal overshadowing, where you yourself do the fooling by verbally describing something that isn't very verbally describable. Now, there aren't many things like that, but there may be some in a cultural context, I don't know. There aren't many things, but other examples are wine. Give someone a wine to taste, get half to write a verbal description, half not to, and then get them to taste 5 or 6 other wines. See which wine they've tasted before. The verbalisation group does much worse. Unless they happen to be experts in wine, and they do have a verbal descriptive ability. colour. And I don't mean red versus green. I mean various hues or various shades of one hue, like various blues, various greens. Being able to distinguish between those is impaired by doing a verbal description of what you've seen. Some voices, not male versus female, but different male voices, and not tenor versus baritone either, but similar sorts of male voices, your ability to recognise those is impaired by a verbal description. There aren't many, but there are quite a few, and faces seems to me in the cultural context to be the most important one. Now, let's move on to proactive interference. And will you indulge me for a minute, please, by writing down as many of those words I said before and asked you to remember. I did kind of warn you we were going to have a little test. I'll give you about a minute. Or maybe a minute's too long. Okay, that'll do. How many people had female? How many people had pregnant? How many people had family? How many people had mother? Wasn't on the list. That's an example of proactive interference, and what happens there is before you heard that list, those people who... it's not everyone who gets it wrong, especially if they're told they're going to be tested on it, which doesn't happen in real life, of course, but enough people do to make it a bit of a worry. What happens there is before you actually heard the list, you have a family schema. You've got nodes in your head and all the family schema, mother, father, you know. Probably if I said father, some people would put up their hands too. It wasn't on the list either. You've got a family node, and as soon as the family context comes up, it activates all the things that belong to that family node. Now, that's called... how embarrassing. That's called the Dees-McDermott-Rodiger effect. No, Dees-Rodiger-McDermott effect, DRM effect. Don't bother remembering it. But there is another type that probably for cultural reasons is more interesting to you. The Dees-Rodiger one is an intra-cultural effect. I want to talk about cross-cultural effect, and I would like to read you a story which some of you may have heard before. This is taken back from 1932, a book in 1932, and it's a very clever experimenter called Bartlett. And what Bartlett did, amongst other things, he wrote a whole book on it, was give people a story to remember that came from a culture that was not their culture. Now, our stories they've got timelines and they have a logical sequence, etc., etc., etc. North American Indian stories don't have that sequence, as you'll hear when I read this story. And then I'll tell you what he found. One night, two young men from Egulac went down to the river to hunt seals. And while they were there, it became foggy and calm. Then they heard war cries and they thought, maybe this is a war party. They escaped to the shore and hid behind a log. Now canoes came up and they heard the noise of paddles and one canoe came up to them. There were five men in the canoe and they said, what do you think? We wish to take you... Making any sense? No. We wish to take you along. We're going up to the river to make war on the people. One of the young men said, I have no arrows. Arrows are in the canoe, they said. I will not go along. I might be killed. My relatives do not know where I have gone. But you, he said, turning to the other, you may go with them. Brave, wasn't he? So one of the young men went, but the other returned home. And the warriors went on up the river to a town on the other side of Kalama. The people came down to the water and they began to fight. And many were killed. But presently the young man heard one of the warriors say, quick, let us go home. That Indian has been hit. Now he thought, oh, they are ghosts. Making any more sense? Not really. He did not feel sick, but they said he had been shot and made a fire. And he told everybody and said, behold, I accompanied the ghosts and went to fight. Many of our fellows were killed and many of those who attacked us were killed. They said I was hit and I didn't feel sick. We've got I didn't feel sick, but I didn't feel sick. He told it all and then he became quiet. When the sun rose, he fell down. Something black came out of his mouth. His face became contorted. The people jumped up and cried. He was dead. Now, What Bartlett did, he gave that story, he was English, to an English university population, and after a suitable interval, he tested them. And they had absolutely no conceptual framework for dealing with that sort of a story that has no logical sequence and has strange ideas and strange names, like, I can remember it because I've read it many times, Egulac, but you probably couldn't remember it, and I can't even remember the other one, Kalama. And what he did was he tested people, and what they did was they turned it into a nice logical sequence. Egulac became something like Jonestown, and the black thing coming out of its mouth became his soul leaving his body, etc., etc. But even more importantly in this context, he got the method of repeated repetitions. Now, Indigenous people often don't have a written history, it's an oral history. And the method of repeated repetitions, you're getting not only the proactive interference, you're getting the retroactive interference. So somebody gives their version of the story to the next person, gives it to the next person, and by the go down 10 people, the story is totally unrecognisable from what it originally was. Now, it seems to me that in this sort of context, how are we going for time? Oh, good, okay. I've been told I have to hustle this up a little, so I'm hustling it up a little. In this context, that repeated repetition in cultures that have an oral tradition are something to be asked when you see what people are reinstating in the landscape. And I was fortunate enough recently to have a trip to the Kimberley, and I saw this illustrated two ways, how you impose your cultural ideas on another culture's work. Now, we saw Bradshaw art and we saw Wandjina art. And I can't remember if it was the Bradshaw or the Wandjina art, we saw an animal depicted. It's all representational art, not allegorical art, it's representational. And we saw this picture, and it had a sort of a little hint of a stripe on it. And, of course, white people, with their knowledge of zoology, say, ah, that proves the thylacines were on the mainland. And, of course, it doesn't prove any such thing. We don't know what's in the mind of the artist. It might mean that thylacines are on the mainland. It may not. Now, the other way around, and I've told this to Leanne, she has to listen to it again, was definitely Wandjina art, and it was on Biggie Island, B-I-W-G-E. I don't know why I call it Biggie, because the man that found the island, they call him Big, but they call the island Biggie Island. But anyway, they had... Wandjinas are... There are only three clans in Western Australia, I think, that believe that Wandjinas are the creators rather than the rainbow serpent or the olive python or whatever. And Wandjinas are human-type creatures, but they have no mouths. And what we saw in Biggie Island was a representation which was probably of white people, because they had pipes coming out of their mouths. And the pipes were out of all proportion to the size of the pipe. But, I'm sorry, coming out of where their mouths would have been is what I should have said, because they don't have mouths. But out of that part of their face, a big pipe came out. Not only that, but they had big square things on their feet that could have been clogs. But the interesting thing was, because it was Wandjina art, these people had interpreted within their framework. They made these, what were fairly obviously, though it's again it's interpretation, white people into Wandjinas, because they thought they knew God. So that Wandjinas have halos around their heads, and each of these white people with the pipe and the big things on their feet had a Wandjina halo. Now, that is how people put their own interpretation. They're both examples of proactive, because we have an idea in our head as to what a thylacine looked like. This had a little bit of a stripe, might have been a dingo, a misformed dingo, it might have been a bad artist, who knows. But so what I've said today is it's not practical archaeology, it's not practical anthropology, but I think if I've caused you to ask what it is what's being represented in these landscapes something that really happened, something that's really veridical, or is it something, as to use Louise's term, refracted through experience, either before the event that's being represented or after the event. Now, I wouldn't want you to think that they were the only sources of illusion, memory illusion. They aren't. Things happening, it doesn't have to be retroactive, it doesn't have to be proactive. It can be happening contemporaneously with the event you're experiencing. And there's a wonderful story about a psychologist in Australia who became the father of forensic psychology in Australia, and became the father of forensic psychology in Australia because he not only had a PhD and postdoc experience in America in psychology, he also was a barrister. And he was on television one night and a woman was watching him, and she was raped while she was watching him. Later on, she identified him as the rapist. Now, that happened contemporaneously. Something happened at the same time. It's the only face she saw. And so she luckily, he was able to say he had a perfect alibi. He was in a television studio and lots of people watching him. But that's another source of memory illusion. But the point is, the sources don't matter so much. The point is, memory might be accurate. It's just as likely not to be. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judy. That was a splendid introduction to the substance of today's papers and a very good lead-in into Mike Pickering's paper. Mike, you can see his bio notes there on the in the program. He's vastly experienced in dealing with the realities and the practical and often legal consequences of people's memories, groups' memories in relation to land. He's here at the museum, of course, heading the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program, and it's about Indigenous memory that he's talking to us, looking at the relationship between individual and group memories. Mike, thank you. Looks like Waterloo Station here, isn't it?
Sorry.
Actually, I'm doing nothing of the sort. That's true. I'm talking nothing about Indigenous memories, although the whole project, what I am doing, does stem from my studies with Indigenous people. I've just taken the theory. I'll take it from here, righto. Where are we? Memory two. We'll start here. Will we? Okay. As I'll make clear. It's a true confession. It's a shameless reworking of the theoretical section from my long-forgotten doctorate. In that research, I was looking at hunter-gatherer settlement patterns at various scales and what information might be contained at those various scales. Particularly interested in distinguishing the short term from the long term, the individual from the population, local from regional, and range of behaviour from patterns in behaviour. There's a distinction which I'll hit you with now. How we're sitting in this room reflects the range of people sitting. Take away the fact that we're all sitting in this room reflects the pattern of behaviour. So you get variability and then you get this sort of coherent network. Now, also as I go through, there's probably German words in anthropology to describe what I'm talking about, but I don't know what they are. I've even reworked my old illustration. See if you can pick cunning mistakes. But when thinking about presenting at this symposium, I was reminded that settlement patterns, of course, are defined by economic, religious, historical, intellectual and emotional affiliations to place by people, both by individuals, by individuals' families and populations. And perhaps those theoretical considerations that apply to a physical positioning in the landscape also apply equally to the landscape of memories of place. The methodological and theoretical dimensions of this talk will therefore address the distinction between microscale and macroscale phenomena. How is this relevant to the work of a museum? Well, in my opinion, many museum collections, if you look at them individually and closely, are dysfunctional. While most people discard the bulk of the physical bric-a-brac of their lives and the lives of their parents and grandparents, keeping the memory but certainly moving on by clearing the stuff out of the house, There are groups who do obsessively collect or retain the physical remainders of their past. Is this passion for collecting, is this passion for reliving the past truly a reflection of those events relevant to a nation's history? How can a museum understand and classify the memories, histories that it presents without reference to the scale of the attributes associated with its collections? Are there attributes applicable to understanding individual histories that may not be applicable to understanding corporate histories? Memories of place. This little illustration here is the Korean War Memorial, My children laid the flowers at the foot of the war memorial on the day my father died. He was in Melbourne, and I was in Melbourne as well. You know, again, it's a memory of place to many, and it's a memory of place to my family. I'll proceed through an examination of the concept of landscapes, then on the theories of location and scale. Oops, wrong one. Go away. Don't worry too much about the pictures. They're there because eye candy is good. It keeps people awake and entertained. I'll proceed through the location of the theories of location and scale. And as I say now, this fascinating theoretical consideration will be balanced by totally irrelevant images of my travels. These are places of which I have memories and occasionally places of which other people here in the audience may also have memories. When do our memories, probably separated in space and time, converge to define a more corporate memory of place? What is a landscape? What is a place? How small are they? How big is it? The terms landscape and environment are often treated as synonymous. Well, they're not. They actually reflect different phenomena. The concept of a landscape emphasises the human cultural processes that both materially and symbolically shape landscapes. Landscapes are, first and foremost, products of human action and perception. They are cultural. Not only do humans interact physically with the environment, they also perceive and interpret environments through the medium of culture. Landscapes thus have a symbolic component, which is not always visible in the spatial and temporal arrangement of objects in the landscape itself. Every landscape has to be interpreted. Take away the mechanism of interpretation, basically leave, and it ceases to be a landscape. Landscape requires culture to interpret it. We have a roomscape here. The roomscape I see will vary if I go over there. It suddenly becomes a different roomscape, and I choose which one I prefer to address you through. Well, I don't, because this thing's fixed. Place. What's the definition of place? A place, at its most basic, it's simply a fixed position where an object, structure, or tissue is placed or where something occurs. That's an official definition. The defining characteristics of a place will depend upon the scale of resolution applied in the definition. For example, at the micro scale, a site may be a place where someone sat for an hour, whereas at the macro scale, it may be a permanent community, a permanent a city. It's important to distinguish between a place as a specific site or as a locale. A site can be the location of a specific event, whereas a locale is the location of contiguous events. The relationship between a place and a site, locale, or combination of both site and locale should be coming up in one of my illustrations somewhere. Maybe not. Okay, forgive me for this. My time wasting. Memory 2. It was after FA. There we go. It's fast, isn't it? Look at that. It's boovering away. Okay, now, and naturally enough, it's all askew. Let's have a fiddle. Now, hopefully, you can see that all right. You've got a resolution at the various scales. Now, this, if we get up really close, you know, here's a standing pool. Here are places around the side of the pool. Now, it looks like the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, there's 10 spaces, 10 places there. They're sites. That's where something's happened. Someone sat down, they've had a picnic, someone's played a game of football or something else, whatever. If you move away, if you increase the scale, so here it's a 1 to 100 scale, everything starts to coalesce and you start to form this locale. It's that whole pool, the whole lake, the whole geographic feature becomes the place of discussion until you get to this level where, again, pulling back, looking at it's that location again and incorporates all these particular sites. So it depends very much on the scale. You know, think of it as visiting the museum. Tracking you at the level of the individual would show great variation in movements and time spent at various exhibits, whereas treating you all simply as visitors to the museum would have you all in exactly the same place at exactly the same time. So the number of sites with any given area will vary according to the size of that locale. Despite local variability in the location of the sites, the locale remains a consistent point of experience. Next, we get to pattern versus range, as I touched on earlier. One attribute of the practice of history is the difficulty in corresponding micro-episodes or micro-events with macro-episodes or macro-events. Individual experiences are not directly multipliable to reflect the experiences of a population and vice versa. There's always the risk that minor events or experiences may be disproportionately represented. The emphasis in many studies is often on the expanding the range of episodes, even when they're rare and unusual, rather than looking for patterns or uniformity in events. As one author has commented, this is the faraway places with strange-sounding names school, which emphasises the range of the human condition, often with a profound neglect of central tendencies. There's often a pressure to present new and unusual information rather than information that may be repetitive but still lead to the identification of representative patterns in experience. The process is structuring phenomena at the short term, the local and the individual, and not necessarily identical to the processes that structure phenomena at the long-term regional or population levels. Different processes operate at different scales, and simple multiplication of or reduction of processes and phenomena to explain at one scale, to explain phenomena observed at an opposite scale is inadequate and misleading. How am I doing for time here? Okay, good. The major problem associated with resolution and comparison of phenomena within and between dimensions and scales is whether identification of the processes and phenomena that dominate at the micro scale reflect the processes of phenomena and phenomena that dominate at the macro scale. It cannot be assumed that the actions or attributes of the individual, say what I might find as a significant event, or what a donor may find to be a significant event, are representative of the actions or attributes of the group or of the population, say what the nation chooses to remember. Individuals have experiences that are not experienced by all members of the population at the same time. Documenting the experiences of individuals over the short term will tend to identify the range of experiences of that individual, rather than describe the long-term patterns in the experiences of the population. Just let me get back to my disk, and we'll try some more pretty images. As one author has suggested, the basic question is, what is the appropriate scale for analysing human activities, individual, small group, large group, or state? These are not discrete entities. Rather, they are specific scales along a continuum of possibilities. Three dimensions considered particularly relevant here are the spatial, temporal, and demographic. They'll never let me use one of these machines again. I'll always have to... Interpretive dance will be my next thing. Principles of location. The spatial dimension refers to a geographic area covered by an inquiry. The temporal dimension refers to the duration over or within which phenomena and influencing variables are manifest. The demographic dimension refers to the size of the human group performing or participating in particular phenomena. These three dimensions operate and interact dynamically within a cultural system. Each dimension extends in scale from the micro to the macro, and the micro scale provides a very fine-grained resolution, while the macro scale is coarse-grained. The micro scale is research at the short term, the individual or small group, and the macro scale is research at the level of the long term, the aggregate group or the population, and the processes which influence group actions. While the distinction between macro and micro is often recognised, there's been little development of method or theory that articulates the two extremes. They therefore represent the two extremes on the climb. At each scale, particular phenomena are likely to dominate in terms of resolution and frequency. Each level of scale has the potential to address different problems and to complement and expand on information discernible at the other scales. I'll leap a bit here. Studies of the use of space at the micro scale. This is one of the theories. It's a geographic cultural geography. Co-location over space and time. Okay, co-location over space and time. You can imagine this is one example. This area is space and here is time. This is an individual. This might be me and this might be you. I walk along, we come to this conference, I sit in this chair, at this time, you come along, come to this conference, sit in that chair at this time, morning tea comes, and we both go off in our different directions. So we co-locate in time, not necessarily in space, because we're sitting in different seats. I won't use that when I'm talking about co-location in space, because it'd have us sitting on each other's laps. Co-location in space, but not in time. Okay, here we are again. This is one particular chair in this room, for example, this little thing here. Here's me, and I come. You know, we'll start with you. You come in, you sit in this chair, you get up and you leave. I come in, I sit in that chair later. So we're co-located in space, but not in time. And here we have a co-location in time and in space, which is both of us decide we want to fight over who gets to sit in this chair during the seminar. Okay, but what in the nature of history, memories, of course, we can think about this as we co-locate in space. Here we have a shared memory. Or theoretically there is a shared memory of that place at the same point in time. Whereas in the others, we can see here we have our own memories developing about the same place at different points in time. Now, this is all very much at the level of the individual and the short term. A few more pretty pictures of place. Now, there's a place. This is where the tooth fairy came to get my daughter's tooth some years ago. We used to lay these little traps. So there's the $2 for the tooth fairy under the glass. Here you'll see the footprints of the tooth fairy as the tooth fairy went from sugar to biscuit to a drink of water, and then the little footprints over here to eventually take the tooth and leave the $2. We got away with that with two kids for so long. So, you know, there's a little model of place, but... Again, it gives me fond memories. That's why it's there. Clouds, people looking at a salt lake. The articulation of dimensions of space, time, and demographic unit occur as people move through space and time. Places reflect people occupying points in space and time. Some places are regularly visited, some rarely, others rarely. Places with repeated visitation will generally represent major places in long-term and macro-geographic patterns of visitation and experience. Uluru is an example. It's become a major site of national and international significance. The orange tree in my backyard is not a place of great international interest. Because it's not visited as regularly by as many people. Nonetheless, within the full suite or range of potential places, certain localities will always be visited more frequently, for longer, and by a larger number of people, reflecting trends or a pattern of visitation. The articulation of the dimensions of space, time, and demographic unit is shown through the application of the principles of return in space, co-location, and reunion, which I've just mentioned. Look, there's co-location in space and time. That's tourists at tourist buses at Uluru at sunset. Okie doke. When I started drawing these, there was no such thing as computer programs. When I finished them, everyone was doing their graphics on computers. I eventually published them in an article, and one of the critics said, well, you know, the article was pretty crap, but the computer-generated illustrations were fantastic. I felt so proud. Now, I'm not sure how the scale is showing up there, but hopefully you'll get the gist of... Okay, you get this variability in place over space and time. This, you know, if we looked at... This chart's movements over space and time of several individuals. It could be several individuals. It could be several communities. It's model based. If we map them, that was totally accidental. Over space, you find there's all these different locations which are occupied over the long term. All these different places become significant over the long term through repeated visitation. Whereas up here, if you look at it synchronically, some of them have very, very low levels of visitation. So something that might happen in the short term. At the level of an individual, over a year, you might have this sort of pattern emerging. And similarly, 2 years later, this sort of pattern. Everything suggests that this is not a popular place. This is not a place of great memory. But if we look at it over the long term, we find that it does become a place of frequent occupation, of large visitation and and as a, you know, correspondingly of people's memories and experiences. Sorry about this. I'm just trying to race through some of the things. Further on. Variability at the micro scale becomes patterning at the macro scale, which is probably, in effect, very much a summary. This is, again, the individuals, you know, moving frequently and, you know, over space and time as we go to the shops, as we go to the pictures. We all do it individually. Sometimes we travel together, sometimes we don't. You can see the scale here is large. It doesn't need a definition by metres. It's just simply, this is the diversity which is indicated at our individual activity levels. But if you reduce the scale, that activity starts to compress into a more regular pattern. This is what we're doing, Canberra people are doing today. They're getting up and they're going to work. And here we are. Let's just pretend this little section here is all of us here in this conference. You know, at time and space, we've all co-located. This is us at small scale, spread around this room, but nonetheless, we're all here in this hall. And this is what happens over time. This is just probably not even particularly relevant, but it does show that this is where the patterns emerge. The pattern is, you know, there's a central core of the central tendencies with a hinterland, an outer area of where there is some diversity, but still concentrating on that central core. Okay. All right, I'll actually race ahead to wrap it up. I think that you've got the general shift, the gist, which is I'm looking for those. There you have patterns and you have range. Which ones are important? Which ones are significant, especially as a historian or someone working in a museum? What story do you try and tell? What does all this information suggest? Spatial and temporal scales of phenomena will have direct bearing on the theoretical approaches applied in their examination. This tells us that all stories, all memories, have their place. No pun intended. It all give insights into that rich tapestry that is our lives and also the lives of the wider society. It also reminds us that collective individual experiences do not inherently make the big picture story. Having 100 narratives does not necessarily lead us to the grand national story. Nor, however, does the big picture story necessarily reflect the lives and experiences and passions of its actors. I'll just close with some anecdotes. In the late 1980s, I was working on a land claim in the Northern Territory. It was the Roper River claim, which included large tracts of the lands of Elsie Station, which is, of course, the station in Weir of the Never Never. The senior informant, a wonderful old man in his 80s, told stories of Elsie Station having sheep. Younger men, those in their 60s, laughed this off, saying that he was addled, he was just too old and didn't know what he was talking about. It turned out that there was a brief experiment in raising sheep on Elsie Station, but because it was outside the memories of the majority of people there, it was a myth of the individual rather than a historical reality. More recently, in late 2005, the National Museum bought a painting called Mistake Creek Massacre, which was painted in 1997 by Queenie McKenzie, who's a prominent Aboriginal artist. The painting told the story of an incident in 1915, the massacre of 8 Aboriginal men, women and children at Mistake Creek in the East Kimberley of northwestern Australia. The painting depicts Aboriginal and Europeans with guns directing Aboriginal people to build the funeral pyre before they are killed. A baobab tree and the plaque erected by the Sisters of St. John are also depicted in the painting. Just try and zoom in a bit for this one. This is from an article in the Bulletin. Debate surrounds the historical accuracy of the event depicted in the painting. While the fact that the killings did occur is not contested, the question is whether the killers included Europeans, as is the Aboriginal belief, or whether it was purely an Aboriginal party in an internecine fight, as is the conservative non-Indigenous belief. So we have the Indigenous story, which has the linesman coming up with Aboriginal assistance and killing people. Then we have the police records, which say that only the Aboriginal people took the guns. The proposal for acquisition made it clear that both accounts had aspects which could be supported by the evidence. But the real significance of the painting and the story was in their capacity to address issues of how histories are formed. They just didn't agree with each other. The museum acquired the work. After internal scholarly debate as to the relevance and application of the work, the process for collection acquisition is one of structured peer review of object and argument. It was referred eventually to the Museum Council. It was acquired and was referred to the Museum Council. Its inclusion in the National Historic Collection was refused, however, because a single Museum Council member, Mr. David Barnett, quote from this article in the Bulletin, is understood to strongly hold the view that the massacre never happened at Mistake Creek and the painting should not be admitted to the National Historical Collection because it is a lie. In short, one person was sufficiently empowered to contradict and override the advice of a group of professional historians and Indigenous informants on the basis of a personal opinion. What does this mean? It means that there's much more to understanding memories of place and the places of memory than mere historical accuracy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. And from one Pickering to another. We can already see themes and commonalities emerging in this conference, which is very cleverly structured, Leanne. And we move on to a paper by Professor Paul Pickering, who's convener of graduate studies at the Research School of Humanities at ANU, and is a distinguished scholar of the political implications of historical memory, and especially in 19th century Britain, a period of great fecundity and diversity in generating and celebrating and arguing about historical memory. Paul is also a great friend of the National Museum, and it's a pleasure to welcome him here today. Over to you. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. If Judith's correct, then there's absolutely no chance that you'll remember or distinguish between Mike and I. And so you'll be asking me about space and him about terrorism. I'm hoping that perhaps some of my slides will be graphic enough that you'll associate them with me and remember it. Today we are meeting in what might be properly termed the ambivalent legacy of John Howard, the National Museum that we had to have, the place that he built with our dollars that came to symbolise for most people on the right of politics in Australia a bastion of political correctness and black armband history, a dissolute child of conservatism. The so-called history wars, initiated as they were by prime ministerial acolytes and ideological gatekeepers, produced a lot of hot air, considerable column inches in the Australian newspaper and Quadrant magazine, and an important book by Stuart McIntyre and Anna Clark. We sometimes forget, however, that the NMA was only one front in the history wars. There was also the attempt to rewrite the national history curriculum to include facts, 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 to use a Dickensian turn of phrase, to devote more class time to Don Bradman than to frontier conflict. Second, there was the brazen attempt to distort public memory through the allocation of research funding. The big winner during the Howard years was military history. Marilyn Lake has shown how government bankrolling of the production of historical knowledge can very quickly and fundamentally shape national history. There was also the attempt to shape our sense of national identity by requiring all schools to display a list of national values against a motif of Simpson and his donkey. The poster was controversial for a range of reasons, not least of which because it seemed to suggest a broader agenda. The Minister for Education, Dr. Nelson, indicated as much when he highlighted the importance of that these values and that they be taught in Islamic schools, and he suggested that they should be linked to citizenship. If people don't want to accept and embrace those values, then they ought to clear off. I don't care where they're from, he said. Of course, this impulse would later reach maturity in the citizenship knowledge test. Other commentators, however, hinted that it was worth looking more closely at the man at the centre of attention. As many of you will know, John Simpson Kirkpatrick became famous for his work as a stretcher bearer and as the man with the donkey at Gallipoli. And he saved a number of people under heavy fire in that context. Nevertheless, there were other reasons that Kirkpatrick was an unlikely choice for a poster issued by the Howard government in 2006. Kirkpatrick was born in England, he was an active trade unionist and a socialist. According to some sources, he was indolent and a sloppy dresser. He came to Australia in 1910 as part of the Merchant Navy, and he jumped ship. After he deserted, he tramped around Australia and worked in a variety of jobs. He enlisted in the AIF under a false name, expecting that this would give him a chance to get back to England, but he ended up at Gallipoli. If Simpson were to jump ship in Australia today, as he did in 1910, he would be deported or sent to a detention centre as an illegal immigrant. Now, I'm not trying to detract from Simpson's heroism and sacrifice, far from it. My purpose is to suggest that history is always more complicated than it appears at first glance, and almost invariably contested and shrouded in a mist of cultural amnesia. Now, in a sense, these are soft targets with which I've begun. The facts of Simpson's life are well known, if not to Brendan Nelson and John Howard, and politicians, even education ministers, are not necessarily well-schooled in history. After all, wasn't it Julie Bishop who confused the date of Cook's Landing with the date of Federation? In my paper today, I want to focus on two more intractable and painful public myths that can be teased apart if we are willing to take the risk, and I'll explain the risk a bit later. I'll offer one example from Australia and one from Britain. I do so to make the point that cultural amnesia and the politics of memory are not peculiar to Australia. On the contrary, as Stuart McIntyre has pointed out, many countries have played out their own version of the history wars. And lest I am accused of political bias, I will choose one case of political amnesia from the left and one from the right. Let me start in London. On July 7, 2005, at 8:30 a.m., four men arrived at King's Cross Station in London. They had earlier driven from Leeds in Yorkshire in the industrial north of England to Luton Railway Station, where they had caught the train into central London. There is CCTV footage of them arriving and entering the station at 7:21 a.m. Now, anyone who's familiar with rush hour in London will know the scene that greeted the men that morning. Three of them descended into King's Cross Underground Station. At the confluence of all the major underground stations, King's Cross in the morning is chaotic, with waves of commuters battling against endless queues that snake around the central ticket hall. No matter which train you are waiting for, it will be full when it arrives. And for the first-time visitor, it is miraculous how many people still manage to squash into the densely packed carriages and then open a newspaper or a book and casually start to read. One of the four men, Muhammad Khan, boarded a westbound train on the Circle Line headed for Edgware Road. A second man, Shazid Tanweer, caught an eastbound train on the Central Line headed for Liverpool Street and Aldgate. A third man, Jermaine Lindsay, caught a train on the Piccadilly Line headed to Russell Square. Outside King's Cross Station, a number 30 London bus passed on its way to Hackney Wick. At some point on its route, the fourth member of the group, Hasib Hussein, got onto the bus and took a seat upstairs. At 8:50 a.m, the three young men on the underground trains detonated bombs that they had been carrying in rucksacks. At 9:47, the fourth man detonated his bomb on the bus as it passed through Tavistock Square. The bombs killed 52 commuters and the four bombers and injured 700 people, many of them seriously. The response of the British government, the press and the general public to the events was swift and predictable. A week later, at a Labour Party conference, the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, set the attacks firmly in an international context. What we are confronting here is an evil ideology. It is not a clash of civilizations. All civilized people, Muslim and other, feel revulsion at it. But it is a global struggle, and it is a battle of ideas, hearts and minds, both within Islam and outside it. The implication was clear. What had occurred was not British. In the popular press, the perpetrators were condemned as bastards. Al-Qaeda bastards. Again, the clear imputation is that terrorism and terrorists are foreign, other, unchristian, not British. In fact, if you look up terrorism in the Oxford English Dictionary, you will see that the lexicographers have no doubt that the word and the concept are not British. The word is derived from the French, specifically from the Jacobin Terror of 1793. Public memory and popular understanding on the question of terrorism has therefore been carefully managed from the corridors of power and learning to the Grub Street Press. Well, who were the men who attacked innocent civilians on the 7th of July 2005? Muhammad Khan was born in Leeds and lived in Dewsbury in West Yorkshire. He attended South Leeds High School before going on to Leeds Metropolitan University. After graduation, he worked at a local school as an integration officer, helping immigrant families. He was married with a young daughter at the time of his death. He was 30 years old. Jermaine Lindsay was born in Jamaica, but he moved to England with his parents when he was 5 months old. He grew up in Huddersfield in Yorkshire, where he worked as a carpet layer. He was married with a young child, and his wife was 7 months pregnant with their second child in July 2005. He was 20 years old when he died. Shahzad Tanweer was born in Bradford before moving to Leeds when he was seven. He attended high school where he excelled at sports. He went on to study sports science at Leeds Metropolitan University. He worked part-time at his father's shop at the time of his death. He was 23 years old. The youngest man was Hasib Hussain. He was 18 years old in 2005. He had been born in Leeds and attended school there, excelling in football and cricket. On the morning of the attack, his family contacted the police as though they were worried that he might have been hurt. Now, why am I telling you about these men? My aim is to make the point that whatever else they were British. They were British bastards. I want to make the point that until very recently, the use of violence was normative in British politics, and indeed that there is a striking parallel for anyone familiar with British history. When it became clear that the bombers were actually English, I kept hearing in my head a nursery rhyme that I had learned as a child growing up in North London. Remember, remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. The fact is that many people in Britain, including Tony Blair, have forgotten. In November 1605, Guy Fawkes and his co-conspirators placed a large amount of gunpowder in the Houses of Parliament. The aim was to kill James I. They harboured a politico-religious grievance. They were men, the men were all English, Catholics seeking toleration. Guy Fawkes himself was even born in Yorkshire. He was a British bastard. Despite this, he too was othered by the state. When he was tortured by the authorities following his capture, he was forced to sign his confession Guido Fawkes to make it appear as though he was from Catholic Spain. At 3 a.m. on Sunday, the 3rd of December 1854, a party of 276 police and military personnel approached a roughly constructed wooden stockade erected by protesting miners in Ballarat on the Victorian goldfields. There is no agreement as to which side fired first, but the battle that ensued was fierce and one-sided. At least 27 miners were killed, as well as six soldiers. The place of the Eureka Stockade in public memory is overwhelmingly conditioned by the image of the Southern Cross flag, the Eureka flag. Politicians of all stripes accept the dominant image. During the 150th anniversary celebrations, John Howard predictably banned the flying of the flag at Parliament House. The Labor Chief Minister, John Stanhope, defied him and flew dozens of flags along Northbourne Avenue. And let me remind you of some of those. There's Guy Fawkes. Notice it says Guido Fawkes. And a later poster. I'll come back to that. Notice the dominant motif in all these images about Eureka, the Southern Cross flag, the Interpretation Centre in Ballarat, Flag Stirs Rebellion, Descendants Remember Eureka, the Royal Auto, Northbourne Avenue with the flags, and they extend right down there. PM says no to flag. For historians and commentators of the left, Eureka has understandably been, in the words of H.D. Turner, our own little rebellion. In 1942, a future parliamentary leader of the Parliamentary Labour Party, H.V. Evatt, saw it as a turning point in Victorian and Australian affairs, a sentiment that was echoed by one of his successors, Gough Whitlam, who argued that Australian democracy was born at Eureka. Now, the simple equation of Eureka with republican democracy is, however, another example of cultural amnesia. I first became aware of the problem when reading Raphael Carboni's famous account of the stockade. At one point in that book, Carboni complained that the others in the stockade were keeping him awake with their singing. Now, what were they singing? Was it Erin Gabrach, the song of the revolutionary Irishman? Or La Marseillaise, the song of the French Revolution? Or the Star-Spangled Banner? It was Rule Britannia. Britons shall never be slaves. When I turned my attention to the contemporary newspapers, I discovered an even more astonishing fact, that the stockaders had flown not one flag, but two, the Southern Cross and the Union Jack. Why? As I have argued elsewhere, the rebellion at Eureka is best understood in large part as a British rebellion. Or at least it was an action that was sustained by a popular interpretation of the British Constitution. The demand of the miners was no taxation without representation, a fundamental British right extending back to Magna Carta. In other words, they demanded their rights as Britons. Britons shall never be slaves. Now this is, as I said, a startling example of cultural amnesia. Because the British dimension of Eureka has been totally forgotten. Imagine if John Howard had known about the Union Jack. How different might it have been? How discordant might it have been had he chosen to fly the Southern Cross and the Union Jack at Parliament House in December 2004? Now, since I published an article on this a couple of years ago, I've been asked when we forgot about this. And at that stage, I speculated that it was probably during the radical nationalist 1890s, and certainly by the First World War. But my speculation then was wrong. As I've since discovered, as late as the 1960s, a school textbook from New South Wales clearly showed what the newspapers had reported at the time. There it is. Now, the critical factor in all these episodes, it seems to me, is time. Guy Fawkes has been normalised by the passage of time. His treasonous and rebellious agenda has been simplified or forgotten, although Britons annually burn a guy in effigy and set off fireworks as part of a ritual reenactment of the episode. Not only has Guy been forgiven, he's also become popular. In recent BBC national poll to establish the greatest Briton, Guy came in 30th. Just behind William Wilberforce and David Bowie, but ahead of Francis Drake, John Wesley, and Florence Nightingale. I wonder how long it'll be before Tanweer, Hussein, Lindsay, and Khan are considered Great Britons. Picking at the threads of memory is, as I mentioned before, a risky and thankless business. When I had the temerity to publish an article pointing out that violence had a long history in Britain, and that the London bombers were in fact British bastards, I became embroiled in my own mini history war. For a couple of days, my sins were discussed in the pages of The Australian, and in Quadrant, a journal with which I'm sure you're all familiar, I was branded, and I quote here, a left-wing, postmodernist, terrorist lover. I also received hate mail and threats posted on vaguely disturbing paramilitary patriotic websites. My attempt to explode the Republican myth of Eureka has had an altogether milder response, although the actor Jack Thompson described my claim as bullshit. Now, in closing, let me give you a couple of other examples when time has altered perception and political salience of an episode and the politics of memory is at play. Ned Kelly was the subject of the world's first feature-length motion picture that was released in 1906. The film toured extensively throughout southeastern Australia to packed houses. Significantly, however, the popularity of the film produced a sharp response from the state and was banned in some areas, leading ultimately to the inclusion of a specific clause in the Commonwealth Censorship Act. Subsequent films about Kelly, and there are a number, were either heavily censored or banned outright. As recently as 1956, a play about Ned Kelly by Douglas Stewart was banned during the Olympics because it was felt that it would depict Australia in a bad light for international visitors. Now, how ironic is it that in 2000, at the Olympic opening ceremony, there were hundreds of armed Neds in the parade? Ironic, too, that Ned has become a cash cow for the state that persecuted and executed him. Several studies have emphasised his benefit to the tourist industry. According to the Heritage Council of Victoria, Old Melbourne Jail enjoys 140,000 visitors annually, generating over $1.1 million in revenue. Significantly, it is only the only one of the National Trust 50 properties that makes a profit, and the outcome that is an outcome that is attributed to its close association with Kelly. And Kelly has now been commodified into abstraction, and any hint of his criminality or his political aspirations, such as they were, are long since lost in the fog of cultural amnesia. I could show you any number of examples of this, but here are my favourites. This is Ned Kelly Bargains in Batemans Bay, and just notice what's next door to it. Locksmiths, alarms and safes. And the reductio ad absurdum is undoubtedly Ned Kelly sausages. Man, here I'm speechless. I have a final example where the political agenda has mutated and the public memory has been completely subsumed by a recent representation. I'm referring here to William Wallace, a Scottish knight and landowner who opposed Edward I at the end of the 13th century and ultimately was executed in a rather brutal way, hanged, drawn and quartered, for treason. Now, drawing a metaphor from football, a famous Scottish historian has written that the first international contest between England and Scotland was a lying match, and Scotland won 2-1. The history I won't go into. But Wallace's ancient agenda has recently become a touchstone for Scottish nationalism. But the image, which is now firmly lodged in public memory, is entirely fictional. There are no contemporary portraits of Wallace. And these are the earliest, which actually date from much later. There's Wallace in the middle there in the sort of the toga-looking thing. And here's an 18th century representation of Wallace looking somewhat like a Viking. Now, this is a picture of the recently completed Wallace Monument at Stirling Castle in Scotland, a major tourist attraction. Who does that look like? Mel Gibson. The past is a foreign country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. And if I could ask Judy and Mike to come and sit down at the table and help yourself to a drink while you're about it. Thank you very much, Paul. We're talking about the vagaries of memory. While you were speaking, the other Pickering in the room, or at least the other one other Pickering in the room, handed me a note that reminded me that the name Pickering comes from the town of Pickering in Yorkshire, so that makes you a Yorkshire bastard. So, anyway, thank you to Judy and the two Pickerings for allowing us time for questions and discussion arising from three different but connected and fascinating papers. So the drill will be to please stick your hand in the air. Somebody will hand you a radio mic. You identify yourself for the purposes of the recording, and you ask away. Who's going to be first? Nope, sit. Sit. I'm comfortable with silence at conferences, so I'm happy to stand here for 10 minutes. Actually, I have a feeling, Paul, that I remember your stuff on Eureka. There's a new book out on the Eureka Stockade, which I think is being reviewed in the Canberra Times this coming weekend, which looks at it as a purely military operation and sort of sets the politics aside largely and has a completely different take on Eureka. So we are reminded it's not just a matter of memory, it's a matter, as Mike suggested, interpretation, that Eureka will look different and we will remember it differently because people say new things about it. So it reminds us of the slipperiness of memory. Come on, somebody must have thought of something. Yes, thank you, Alice.
Peter, there's also another new book coming out by Claire Wright at La Trobe, which focuses on the women at Eureka.
Oh, okay.
And that'll tell us another story as well.
Yes, very much overlooked. Yeah. Alison.
Hello, yes, Alison Wishart from National Museum of Australia. I guess I was reflecting on your three papers and thinking about our curatorial practice, and one of the key principles I've been taught in curatorial practice is that we engage people and their memories, or that people bring their memories and their personal experiences to any exhibition or any interpretation, whether it's a cultural site or an exhibition. And having listened to your three papers today, that quite scares me because of the distortion that obviously occurs in people's memories. And you know, as curators, we know that people bring a diverse range of experiences and memories and myths to their own personal interpretive experiences of an exhibition or a place or a site. And I just wondered if any of you had any reflections on that concept of, you know, people bringing their memories to an exhibition or a site. And I know as curators we ask people to remember or reflect on things that are relevant to that experience as well.
Can I have a go at that? I think it depends on what the curators are trying to show. If they're trying to show people's experience and it is a distorted memory, then that's their memory. That's what they're living with. That you're showing their experience. But if you're trying to show historical reality, then that's a different matter. You have to go into it and see if there is a possibility of distortion. I think it depends on what you're trying to show. Does that answer your question? Not really. Yeah.
My own personal view, you know, well, as a curator, as a museum's view now, remembering that I came into museums quite late, every one of our visitors comes in with an opinion based on their own experiences. And you'll see people, they'll stand in front of something and they'll say, that's BS, that's not true, that didn't happen. Or, you know, and usually it's the basis of, oh, you know, the trains always ran on time, and someone will say, no, I got on a train once and it didn't. And that negates the entire story. And it's particularly a problem with Indigenous studies, of course, because people have strong views on what Indigenous culture is all about, and their tolerance is a problem. So when I do an exhibition or if I'm participating in something, I don't care if people say that's right or wrong. I just hope they go out saying, well, I didn't know that. I'm not trying to make people into converts, and I'm not trying to change their experiences. With any luck, we can broaden the way they might look at something. But I don't think we can actually expect to hammer them over the head and change their minds. If we can just influence the way they might look at something on leaving, we've done our job.
There, next to Nancy, but I don't know your name, I'm sorry.
Heather, I'm actually just a
citizen. And Heather, you'll have to wait for the microphone. Yeah. And we won't have any of that talk of I'm just a visitor services host. Let's start again, shall we, Heather?
Hello, I'm Heather. I'm a visitor services host at the museum. I also am a practicing artist. So this conference sits quite firmly within both parts of my life. I think the previous comments are really interesting, and I'm just asking the question, what is the business of a museum? Is there such a thing as real historic truth, and where does that sit? Having said that, the business of Eureka, I'm a person who is a descendant of someone who was within the stockade and one of the women of Eureka, and she was the wife of a Cornish miner. They came from hard circumstances. But she is revered by the Anarchist Society of Australia because she hid three miners under her skirts. And I wonder what were her motives for doing so. Does that make her a terrorist? Does that make her an anarchist? I know that I actually love that memory, and because she is revered by the Anarchist Society of Australia, I actually think it's a complete hoot. But one of the members, the male members of my family, thinks it's absolutely terrible because he believes that she would not have actually wanted that. So where does the context of her desires or what that original history was, how she is seen through the infrastructure of memories such as history societies, museums, etc., how that warps her identity as a person and what does that mean to us? So there we fall back into that notion of how the story is interpreted through all those structures, and where does the museum, where does a museum sit in relationship to that?
Thank you. Does anyone want to take that?
Yeah, two comments. First of all, I'm fascinated there's such a thing called the Anarchist Society of Australia. And presumably they have a president and a treasurer and an executive board, and they hold regular meetings with minutes. The other one is, are there truths? Well, I think there are. Despite the, you know, we'll sit in circles and drink strange things and eat strange things, whatever, and say there is no such thing as truth. I think there are. I think there are events that are truth. And I think we can, you know, I think part of my paper was trying to get out, which is we have all the individual variability, but taken as a collective, the truths do get mapped. Now, they're broad stories, they're big pictures. Eureka happened. People's recollections of what happened there may vary, but if you line up enough people, there'll be enough correspondence with certain parts of their narratives to identify consistent themes. So I'm not afraid to say there are historic truths. Part of the fun is, I think, you know, the historic truth is our Christmas tree, and we might just hang some decoration on it, but at the core of it is still that solid value.
I think there's a tension. I mean, the point I tried to make is that history is always complex, and that museums, because of the nature of the way that they present information, can't be complex. And I think your point is a really interesting one, that what is relevant and acceptable changes over time. Think about the convict past of Australia. For many, many years, it was referred to as the stain, and that people endeavoured to hide the fact that they had convict origins. And now, having a convict in your past is something to be celebrated. It's got an enormous cachet. So the relevance of the past changes over time, and in a sense always reflects the needs of the present. And it strikes me that museums are in a very difficult position. Do they challenge the needs of the present, or do they pander to them?
Thank you. I'd love to take that on, but I think we'll have to make the last question. In the front, please.
I'm Claire Smith. I'm from Flinders University in South Australia, and my question leads on from your comment, but it's actually probably to Mike. And that's your point about the complexity of history and truth. I'm wondering about, is the National Museum thinking about how a digital environment might be used to kind of pull in the different kinds of complexities that actually exist? So I'm thinking, are we thinking that way at all?
A digital environment, is that what you said?
Yeah, so, you know, that can tell lots of different stories in that way and have trails and in different ways. I'm just wondering what the thoughts are there.
Well, if we're talking, say, this is multimedia and web delivery and systems within the museum, we always have great plans for more multimedia, more ways of broadcasting information to give people much more information than is available from the labels. You know, we're only just any museum exhibit is just a tiny, tiny tip of a pyramid of information. And nobody enters a museum to read the equivalent of a PhD thesis in a couple of hours, which is what you often ask people to do. If you went through a museum and said, how much words? Other forms of delivery that allow people to engage more deeply at a particular, you know, this has taken my interest. I'm going to hook in with my iPhone and see what the longer story is, or I'm going to go home and do it on the web. We'd like to do that, of course, and that's, I think, all museums are really looking forward to embracing that sort of technology. The big problem, of course, is the money. So, yes, the spirit is there, the theory, philosophy, everything's there except the budget.
Now, thank you very much. The technology we're about to embrace is that of the teacup. Thank you very much to all three speakers, and thank you for your participation, and we'll see you at 10 to 5, to 11.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.